Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible by underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent, and I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. According to the most recent Bureau of Justice Statistics National Crime Victimization Survey, say that 16 times, U.S. residents aged 12 or older experience 3.1 million violent victimizations, and U.S. households experienced an estimated 13.3 million property crimes in 2017 alone. To raise awareness about crime victims' issues and rights, and to honor victims and the professionals who serve them, the week of April 7th through the 13th has been designated as National Crime Victims' Rights Week. Today, Dan Dow, County of San Luis Obispo District Attorney, Beth Robb, Assistant Director of the Christopher G. Money Victim Witness Assistance Center, and Tim Murphy, Mass Victimization Advocate, are my guests for the show to talk about the important resources and services available and progress achieved locally in supporting victims. You're invited to participate in our conversation today and call in to be part of the discussion. All you have to do is dial 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. And I want to welcome all three of you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dan, I want to start with you. If you can talk just a little bit about the Victim Witness Program, about this week and this week of honoring, and kind of bring it down local. I gave some big statistics, but how big of an issue is this for us as residents of this county?
Well, thank you so much for having us today. We're very thrilled that you're paying attention and helping the public in San Luis Obispo County learn more about this important Awareness Week, Victims' Rights Week. So in San Luis Obispo County, we were on the cutting edge in 1977, one of the first counties in California to create a specific victim witness assistance program under then Assistant District Attorney Christopher G. Money. And then he became the elected DA, then a judge, and retired and has since passed away. But Chris Money was visionary. He worked with Alameda County's DA at the time, and they both opened up victim witness offices, realizing that oftentimes victims can be overlooked unintentionally because of the criminal justice system and how long it sometimes takes for cases to go through. And so since that time in 1977, almost 42 years ago, we've served victims in San Luis Obispo County, growing numbers every year. In 2017, we peaked with 11,263 victims that we served. And then this last year, the number went down slightly to 10,940. But our attorneys obviously work on those cases, but our victim witness advocates, and Beth is here, and Tim, Beth represents our the management of our victim witness office that has about 15 advocates, and they work day in and day out to serve our victims, to let them know how the process works, keep them updated about their case, make sure that their rights are protected. And on that, I just want to call attention to the fact that our mission is to bring justice and safety to our community through aggressive and fair prosecution of crime and protecting the rights of crime victims. So it's right there in our mission as one of the most important things that we do.
And you're really balancing between the fairness to the individuals that are accused of a crime and then the fairness to the individuals and the families of the individuals that are the victims of the crime.
That's right.
That's got to be a difficult walk.
It is. And because we represent the government, it's our duty and it's ethical, legal, and moral obligation that we also are protecting the defendant's rights, as you point out, and making sure that the process is fair. And so we take that calling and that responsibility very, very seriously.
Marcy, when I was looking at the website, one of the things that that kind of popped out is there's a law that really was started that initiated even more focus on victims' rights.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that law and why that went into effect. What was the incident that occurred that kind of propelled that?
Yeah, so really one of the things that guides our work as advocates is Marcy's Rights, and it's a Victims' Bill of Rights that was enacted into the California Constitution back in 2008. And where it really came from is a tragic incident where Marcy Nicholas, she was a University of Santa Barbara student, and she had been in a domestic violence relationship, and she had broken it off with this boyfriend, and he had stalked her. And back in 1983, he killed her, murdered her. And so about a week after her family had buried her, the mom and brother were visiting the graveside, and they left the graveside, went to the store, and there was the defendant. There was the person who had killed their daughter in the store, and there was a confrontation. It was very ugly, and they thought, okay, why weren't we notified? Where are our rights in this?
Right.
You know, we were traumatized. This happened to us, and so they have really worked and gathered and have moved across the United States with Marcy's Rights and have just gone state by state, and they have a wonderful website that will tell you all the states they're in, and got this signed in. Of course, California, you can see how long it took, too. They started in 1983, and they got in 2008, which but it shows that tenacity and that just really a caring and compassion for victims that they have. And so we adopted it very quickly and really try to inform victims. These are your rights. This is what you can do. Some of them have to be invoked. Some of them are kind of natural, you know, being treated with dignity and respect, right?
Right.
And so we inform victims of their rights and then help them enforce them. Sometimes they do come into conflict with the defendant. And so then the judge has to decide, or we have to work through those issues. So they're a very valuable tool for us. And it's that next layer, you know, part of the slogan for this year that we're looking at is honoring our past and creating hope for the future. And I really think looking at Marcy's Rights, it's really honoring that past, but it also creates that hope. You know, it's that next step in the chain of really getting victims what they need and saying, hey, there's another piece here. It's not just about this crime. These people are impacted, they're traumatized, and they didn't ask to be here through no fault.
Right.
Yeah.
How many people are involved in your program? In delivering the services?
So we have 12 advocates that actually are advocates and work with them. And then we have some support staff. We have 4 interns from Cal Poly that they're usually from like political science or looking to go to law school. And they come in and have an actual caseload that they cover. And then we have CalVCB, which is the California Victims Compensation Board. And there are 3 more employees there too. And really, CalVCB is a state program, but it's a very service that we utilize for victims. Because many times when victims come in, say it's a battery or something like that, they may have medical bills or expenses around this crime. And so that program, we can help them with medical bills. Maybe they need to see a therapist. They can get them kind of back on their feet, per se, and help with that finance piece, and we help with kind of the emotional piece and that piece of it.
How do people find out about that? Do they find out through the police department?
So they find out. Unfortunately, people really don't know about us until they need us. You know, so a lot of times people don't realize we exist until some tragedy has happened.
Yeah.
When they come in, it's kind of our standard to listen to them. What needs do they have? Do they have insurance? Do they not have insurance? What's going on with them personally? And then we introduce them to it. If it's appropriate, we'll say, hey, there's this program. Or we work a lot very collaboratively with our partners. We have advocates that are strictly assigned to sexual assault and domestic violence. And they work very closely with Stand Strong and Rise, which are 2 nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work collaboratively with partners in the community, and then we introduce them to any other services we have.
When we talk about victims, what kind of crimes are we talking about? because, you know, I hear sexual assault or a domestic violence, but, you know, what other victims would qualify as victims?
Well, it could be anything, including the ones you mentioned, but including property crime victims. And so we assign advocates. In fact, our office, I think largely because we started so early, we recognize the importance of it. We have a more robust victim witness office than many other counties do. And so we're able to as well dedicate resources to property crime victims, where in some counties, because of resources that are limited, they're not able to do that. If I could just go real quick back to your last question.
Yes.
So police officers are, when they go out to a scene, say it was a domestic violence situation, they have a Marcy's Rights card and that they give that victim while they're on scene, and they say, here's who you can contact. They give them our victim witness number to call. And then when the report comes to our office, it immediately goes to an attorney for review, but notification is given immediately electronically to our victim witness advocate.
Okay.
They look at it, and they immediately are able to reach out, even before we make a filing decision in a case, to start the services and assistance to that particular victim.
So it's not a wait for the person to contact you. You don't have to.
And where there might be more of a wait is when there's a case that has not been referred to us. A report has been taken, and that agency is still working on it before they have gotten
still
it to us.
Still gathering evidence.
So in those cases, there may be a delay until our office is even aware that that case exists.
Okay. And in those cases, there's a lot of times where we can still get the information, or the family may, because the police were there, reach out to us before we even have the case, in which case we would start services that were appropriate at that time, too.
Yeah. And you said that there's underwriting in some cases for the funding for those services, or those services are
right.
free.
Yeah, for the state program, the state would pay for it for a victim to get like therapy or something. And then what happens is the state then, it's a program where they go after the defendant for restitution to pay that money back to the state, and then it goes to the next victim.
And there's assistance in how to do that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. We walk through how to do the application, and we actually complete the application for them for our parts after they've done their piece, and then put it in and submit it. We can also refer them, like if they get confused along the process of how this works, we hook them up with that, with those staff members for CalCVP, and they do a great job walking them through the process.
The services include things like counseling and referrals. Our office can make the referrals to the list of people that are approved, and they'll go and get their counseling, and that would be direct billed oftentimes if we can write to the state, so there's nothing out of pocket for the victim. But in some cases, the most serious ones, occasionally we have them where relocation is necessary for the safety of that particular person. And while it's not a unlimited amount of money that's there, on the right occasion, we're even able to help in that.
Oh, there's some financial assistance that could come through with that. Do you see a lot of assistance that's needed for seniors? We do have a population that's pretty rich in individuals who are more mature.
Yeah, absolutely. We have actually a unit that is we called it our elder unit, and they work specifically with our elder population. And we have one intern also assigned to that unit. And so it could be any crime. It can be anything from mail theft to homicide to domestic violence, sexual, everything in between for that unit. And they just work with them. A lot of what they do is scams.
Yeah.
A lot of scams. So, and many times when seniors get to us, it could be word of mouth or a neighbor or somebody knows about us. We've had seniors come in where there isn't really a case. There's no defendant. They've been scammed, and now the defendant is gone. And so we will actually, that unit will work with those victims and help them get it reported to the right place, work with the banks, and do what we can at that point to educate people about what scams there are in the community. And they will, that unit will also, our elder unit will go to do presentations to senior centers or wherever about scams. How can you protect yourself against these people? Because we know that scammers target our elder population many times.
So education is another part of what the program offers.
Absolutely. Okay. If anybody does want a presentation around human trafficking, domestic violence, scams, we have presentations on all of those. And can come to them, talk about the resources we have in the community, how it's affecting us locally, and what they can do too.
When you were talking about the statistics, the incidence in crime, has it gone up commensurate with the population, or is it inconsistent with that, do you think? Do you see any alarming trends?
Well, sadly, there's been a lot of what has been called criminal justice reform since 2011. I think a lot of it was very well-meaning reform, but so many changes happened within a few years of each other that it really complicated our criminal justice system and made it hard to track what is the meaning behind some of the statistical changes. But crime has been on the rise since I was elected in 2014. Each year, the number of cases referred to our office has climbed. In 2014, we had 9,698 cases referred to our office. The next year, we had 12,228. In 2016, we had 13,716. In 2017, it reached a peak of 14,114 cases. This last year, 2018, it went down to 12,670. I don't know the reason. I think population is certainly one of the things that's going on. But in addition to that, many crimes that had been felonies are now reduced to misdemeanors, particularly in the area of drugs and theft. Mm-hmm. And that has meant that law enforcement chooses a different tactic in dealing with those issues. And they're not booked in the county jail except for a few exceptions if it's a misdemeanor. And so oftentimes, in fact, because of the fact that many of them are now misdemeanors, they'll spend their time going after the smaller select number of felony crimes that are out there and directing their resources to the most serious crimes. And so at some level, we do believe that law enforcement has directed their resources to the most serious, thereby some of these other cases that used to be investigated and arrested are essentially not being sought after. And so that's part of why I think there was a drop in 2018. But as you can tell, you know, for us to have 14,000 cases in 2017, it's a lot of crime happening for a county of about 285,000 people.
Was there an increase in any specific area that you were seeing more of? It seemed to me that during that time, there was also a rise in more awareness around physical assault and rape, and you know, there was a real incline in that. Did you see anything consistent with that?
You know, interestingly enough, it was mostly property crimes that caused the large number. A lot of burglaries, a lot of theft. Retail establishments, the law used to allow us to charge a felony if you entered a commercial establishment with the intent to commit a theft. And that could be either a felony or a misdemeanor as a burglary. If they went in and stole something, it didn't matter how much that was, it could still be charged as a felony. The law changed, and if you enter a store and you steal something less than $950, it's basically now categorized as retail theft, as a misdemeanor. And so those have gone through the roof. The California Retailers Association has said that they've lost billions of dollars since that happened in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's happening. We've heard of a lot more auto burglaries with people maybe smashing a window in a vehicle and stealing a phone or a wallet or something out of the vehicle. And so that has been a large percentage of the increase in crime. And I think that would probably account for the largest growth that we've
had
locally.
Okay. Yeah. This is Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Our topic today is crime victims' rights, and my guests are Dan Dow, County of San Luis Obispo District Attorney, Beth Robb, Assistant Director of the Christopher G. Money Victim Witness Assistance Center, and Tim Murphy, Mass Victimization Advocate. You too can participate in our conversation. If you've got comments or questions, you can call in at 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. Tim, I want to move over to you because
sure.
I'm kind of both frightened and fascinated by your title.
Understood.
The Mass Victimization Advocate. So that's a new role.
Correct.
Locally.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And talk a little bit about what your role is and what you're going to be doing if you're not doing it already.
Sure, yes. So I want to start off just by saying that echo on the impact of the victim advocates that Beth and Dan were speaking of. I'm a career law enforcement. I retired last year, and I thought I knew what victim advocates did because I'd been in law enforcement. It wasn't until I was in the unit that I really saw and felt the positive impact these advocates have on a daily basis with these crime victims. So my job as the Mass Victimization Advocate is, A, hopefully never going to get activated.
Right.
But obviously, if it does, if we activate the plan that I'm currently building, it will be to get those advocates as quickly and efficiently to the scene of a mass victimization or mass casualty event, once it's safe, obviously, for the advocates to be there, but to get them there as quickly and as efficiently as possible so that they can connect with those victims and their family members as quickly as possible to start that service connection.
And so just for clarity, define a mass victimization situation.
Sure. So unfortunately, the best way to do that is to refer to examples.
Sure.
The tragedy in Las Vegas at the Harvest Festival shooting.
Yes.
Or massacre, and another recent one close by down in Thousand Oaks or in Ventura County, the borderline bar and grill shooting. What we define it as is a single event in which a person commits or intends to commit a crime resulting in the death of three or more people, not including the perpetrator, or a crime intended to kill three or more people that otherwise results in injuries to people, or an incident resulting in three or more deaths due to criminal negligence. So that would be an example you'd see like the Ghost Ship fire currently in the court system up in Alameda County. And for us, any other event where the district attorney or the director of the victim witness unit deems it appropriate for the victim advocates to be at the scene rendering those services.
And if people were to say to you, you know, come on, Tim, it's a great thing that you got a job and you're probably going to be sitting on the couch for the rest of your career because you live in San Luis Obispo. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I wish. I say that with my boss sitting right here. we can't live in that, I hate to use the term fantasy world, but it's not a question of if, but when. We've seen events like this happen around the world and definitely across the United States. And the better way to approach this is to just be prepared. We hope that it will never be activated, but we are part of a region, the California Office of Emergency Services has broken up the state into regions for effective response in the event of an emergency. Our region that we are partners with the victim witness units and the mass victimization advocates in the counties of Kern, here in San Luis, obviously, Santa Barbara, and Ventura County. No one office could handle something like this on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so the concept is to leverage regional resources to better serve the victims that are affected and their families by such an event. So while we can hope that one will never occur, we would be remiss in our obligations and our duties to serve this community if we weren't prepared to address it.
I want to get back and talk a little bit more about that, but our lines are lighting up, so I want to get back to some of these callers. Sandy from Arroyo Grande. Hi, are you there? Sandra?
Yes. Yes, I am. So I was wanted to ask our district attorney if the increase in crime has any sort of correlation between the legalization of marijuana and I know that other states that have legalized marijuana, like Colorado, they saw an increase in crime with that legalization and all these wonderful tax dollars that they thought they're going to get. Suddenly, like, they're having to use these tax dollars and more to fight the extra crime. That's number one. Number two is with the laws about the homelessness, where now they can just go anywhere, where before you had them contained to certain areas, now they can just go free range. And that's number two. Number three, I think it's a politically correct culture that we're living in. I think that people now can't speak up, and, you know, because God forbid they're going to be labeled racist and all of, you know. And mind you that I'm a Hispanic and I can see it. I don't know. We could go on and on about that, but I would just wanted to get his input about that.
Well, thank you, Sandra, for the question. Regarding marijuana that you started with, I'll just say that I think it's still too early to draw a direct connection between legalization of marijuana and crime. That being said, I share your concerns. I have been watching closely what's happened in Colorado. Colorado has reported a huge uptick in emergency room visits, a huge uptick in vehicular accidents and driving under the influence cases that result in vehicular homicide. So I think that at this point it's too early to say exactly what the impact is, but I'm sure there will be some. In terms of the homelessness issue, you know, that's been a growing problem across the country, but especially here on the Central Coast for a long time. I don't see the homeless issue as being a large number of our crimes, although it's often visual because of their taking up residency in our communities where our folks are shopping and doing those sorts of things. So the homeless issue we do need to address, and we're working in our county and in our community on that. We have done more CIT training for our law enforcement. We have done a lot more focus on mental health and diverting resources to folks that need it, that are homeless, many of them. And so we're working on that. And then regarding your last point, political correctness, you know, I don't know whether that's having any effect on our crimes. Certainly culture goes through many different changes in terms of what is acceptable and what is not. And I think our criminal justice system certainly is a reflection of our culture generally. But other than that, I don't really know how to directly answer that part of your question.
Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Sandra. And we're going to go to Kathy. Kathy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. You had a question or comment?
Yes. My daughter was a victim of a molestation back in 2006, which involved both the father and the grandfather. And I was told at the time that we couldn't go forward with prosecuting because they would point fingers at each other. And I'm just wondering if that case could be reopened, and also, is there a statute of limitations?
Thank you, Kathy. Sexual assault is a horrible crime, and it affects people in probably ways that many other crimes don't. Very deep pain caused and just many challenges. They're also extremely difficult cases to prosecute. Law enforcement is faced with, one, trying to collect evidence beyond just the verbal testimony of the victim and perhaps any other witnesses, because ultimately the burden of proof to go forward in court is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very, very high standard. And so, first of all, I have assigned dedicated attorneys and investigators to work on those cases so that they develop the appropriate expertise necessary. It's the caseload that I was on before I was elected as district attorney. They're very, very important to me. But in the area, I'm not sure the age of the victim in this case, but one of the challenges that we have is if we don't have enough evidence to go forward to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime occurred. First of all, it doesn't mean we don't believe the victim. In fact, we do everything we can to reassure the victim that we do believe and support them, and then explain to them what the legal burden is, and what it's not only our legal burden in court as part of our procedure, but it's actually an ethical duty that we have to the lawyer's professional responsibility to only go forward on cases that meet that evidentiary burden. They're very, very difficult. In every case, we make sure that our victim witness advocates are there for them and provide the counseling services and all those sorts of things. But what we don't want to do is go forward on a case when we don't have enough evidence, because that would be setting a victim up for a secondary victimization. And that would be going through the whole process, having to be cross-examined in court by a defense attorney, and then ultimately having an acquittal or a hung jury to where now that victim feels like they were let down by the system, when we really knew better at the front end and knew that we did not have enough evidence to go forward. So they're complicated, they're difficult. I'll give you an example, and the burden of proof is on our office, the people, the government. In a situation of rape of an intoxicated victim, and it happens a lot in the college environment, so we've got Cuesta and Cal Poly, if a victim was raped while they were intoxicated, it's the burden, we have to give a jury instruction to the jury, and we have to prove that the accused person was not reasonable when they believed that the victim was not intoxicated to a level where they could not legally consent. It's a little complicated, but essentially now we're asking 12 people in the community to unanimously decide that that person was not reasonable to think that the other person had consented to the activity. And so it's one of the things that just makes it extremely difficult. We have to consider that jury instruction when we even evaluate a case for filing. And I think Beth wants to come in and talk a little bit.
Sorry, did I look anxious? Yes, I do. Thank you for your call, Kathy. And certainly I agree with Mr. Dow that this is a horrible molestation. Sexual assault and domestic violence is probably the hardest caseload that advocates work. One of the missions of victim witness is to reduce the frustration that victims and their family members experience when a crime is committed against them. And so even when a case does not go forward, we as advocates want to make sure that we are providing the services for the victim through counseling, through whatever that means. And that being said, I would like to take this moment to just give our contact information. If you know somebody who needs services because they are a victim of a crime, our number is 805-781-5821. And we are also, you can go to the district attorney's website and get information about our services there as well. So when this case didn't go forward as well, the services victim witness provides still go forward. So just because a case is not filed or prosecuted doesn't end where victim witness continues with them.
How long after a crime is committed can they contact victim witness?
For services, mm-hmm. we have victims
for
call
support.
Us for support. Right now, we have a human trafficking victim that calls us back about every 6 months or so to check in and see if there's something new.
There's no legal limitation.
There's no legal. Okay. Yeah, they can, if they feel of need, if they've been victimized, they can call us and maybe we can hook them up with a new resource. Maybe they just need to talk.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's no, limitation on that.
Okay.
But Kathy did ask about the statute of limitations. So,
yes.
In these kinds of crimes, the statute of limitations is longer, but if it was already investigated by law enforcement, the statute will have begun to run. It all depends on the age of the victim and the facts of a particular case and what crime we believe was committed as to what the specific statute of limitations is. But for children victims, the statute is very long. If it was already investigated, though, that would make that time period begin to run. So I would encourage you to reach back out to the investigating agency if you still have questions about that. And if you're not satisfied that you have the right answer, feel free to call our office and we can also look into the matter. I don't know if the case was referred to our office or just stayed with the agency.
Kathy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You get your answers there?
Yes, I'm probably going to have to call because, we've been through all the process.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know if it was longer than 10 years or, if it could be possibly reopened.
You'll need to call. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunately, the answer is it all depends, and it really depends on the specific facts. So I would encourage you to call the arrest or the investigating agency, and then feel free to reach out to my office.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And thank you, Kathy. You're listening to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker, on KCBX, your public radio station from Salinas to Ventura, and on the web at kcbx.org. The San Luis Obispo County Victim Witness Assistance Program is one of the special programs designed to reduce the trauma and insensitive treatment victims and witnesses may experience following crime. Since 1977, they've been committed to helping crime victims and their families reorganize and reclaim their lives. To help empower victims, they inform victims of their legal rights and how to exercise those rights. To help reduce the trauma and suffering following the crime, they offer a wide variety of special crisis and support services to victims, including linking them with other local and state agencies. My guest today, Beth Robb, Assistant Director of the Christopher G. Money Victim Witness Assistance Center, Dan Dow, County of San Luis Obispo District Attorney, and Tim Murphy, Mass Victimization Advocate, are here with me. Today's show is live, of course, and you are welcome to participate in our discussion. You can call in with your questions by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. And we're going to take a call from Victoria. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
Thank you for waiting.
Oh, sure.
How can I help?
Well, I'm actually calling on behalf of my partner.
Okay.
He was in a rear-ended accident, and as a cautionary thing, he went to a chiropractor to see, you know, if he might have a whiplash. And the man actually injured him. I won't go into all the details, but he kind of ran out of the office just so, you know, traumatized and incensed. And he tried for a number of months after. First he was in shock, and then for a number of months after, he tried to get some response from someone that might be able to help him get some compensation from the fellow, because he feels like he needs some treatment because he's still in pain. It's been over a year. And basically the chiropractor kind of led him on, oh, I'll help you, and we can do this and that. But every time he would try to get some kind of thing resolved through the chiropractor, he'd just kind of drop it or not answer or not respond. And so basically, because it wasn't a heavy, remunerative type case for a lawyer, no one wanted to represent him. So he just felt like he was kind of lost in a shuffle, and it didn't... And he still has pain, and he just has this insult of injury of someone that he thought was supposed to help him. Is he a type of person that could contact your agency also? He's just been very kind of, again, traumatized by it and still suffers emotionally and physically from this.
Victoria, thank you for calling. My question, though, for you is, was the person who was driving the other vehicle and rear-ended your partner, was that person prosecuted for what they did, to your knowledge?
No.
Okay, so without a criminal case, that would be one where we typically are not able to get involved. If he had been cited for either a misdemeanor or some other traffic violation for causing that accident and that injury, then we would have the criminal court case in which the judge could order that the driver of the vehicle take care of whatever injuries that he caused. And so we don't provide the same kind of relief the civil court system would provide. In fact, in those situations, if there's no criminal proceeding, then really the only other option out there for an individual is to reach a, you know, either do something in small claims, if the limit is below the maximum for small claims court, or hire an attorney to do a civil action against the driver and or their insurance company that they used when they were driving that vehicle.
But he didn't. He felt that the chiropractor is the one that injured him. He didn't actually have pain from his rear end accident. He had pain after he left the chiropractic office.
So that again would be a different thing. If the chiropractor had intentionally caused him harm, then it would potentially reach into criminal enforcement. But because that may be that the chiropractor didn't use the right types of procedures and provide the right kind of treatment, that would be a completely civil action. The only way to receive anything from that chiropractor would be through some kind of either a settlement without an attorney or hiring an attorney and having them help in your communications with that chiropractor.
And is there a statute on that? Is that
there
a
one, is,
one
but
year statute of limitation?
There is a statute. I can't give any legal advice, quite frankly, and I don't know because I'm not a civil attorney. My expertise is criminal law, but we have some amazing folks in our County Bar Association. I would recommend you go to our SLO County Bar website. They have a legal advice line or a line where they can refer to some lawyers who may answer some of your questions if you can't afford to hire an attorney. But I definitely recommend you reach out to the County Bar Association.
Okay,
Victoria.
Thank you.
Okay, interesting question from Victoria. And I'm going to, while we got this little break in calls, I want to get back to you, Tim.
Sure.
So talk a little bit about the plans currently being made to respond to a mass casualty. What are you doing?
So when I first got into the office, I had to learn the office, if that makes sense, and get a feel for the natural workflow or the existing workflow. So the management has been great to let me have that time to get to know the unit and the advocates working in there. Everyone's been great to get me up to speed. Once I started getting acclimated to those to the new environment, I started building the plan. And the plan would be, it's a little tricky because the staff in there work Monday through Friday, and they can be called out after hours, but that's not necessarily a normal set of circumstances. So I have to build a plan to get these advocates at a moment's notice, quite honestly,
right,
from home or from the office to the scene with gear or the tools or resources they're going to need to get their job done effectively. So I'm putting together a plan. We have to be sensitive to the advocates' wishes, meaning some advocates, and this is completely understandable, don't want to go to a scene, something like this. That's fully understandable, and the court process still needs to occur. So we definitely need to be sensitive to their needs and wishes, but also take advantage of that, quite honestly, so that someone is still there to staff the office. We need to, part of the plan would be to get advocates to the scene, and then there obviously has to be a built-in relief team that would go out to take their place, because studies of all these events that have been happening over the last 10 to 12 years that have, you know, kind of been on the uptick, unfortunately, have shown that you can plan on at least about 3 days of nonstop work. Obviously, that depends on the scope of the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But you can plan on about 3 days, 12-hour shifts, and getting people to those scenes, to a place. The common term for where they would be working is a family assistance center. And so the plan would be to get those folks wherever they might be, whether it's at home or at work, depending on the day of the week and the time of the day, to the office, get the gear, and go. And get down to that scene and start integrating and working with our public safety partners who are managing the criminal investigation and handling that, with the other first responders who are dealing with the injured and other victims and casualties, and then putting our team into place to start working with the family members and other folks who are going to be there to support the victims.
So are the advocates volunteers that are being trained, or these police officers?
It's all victim witness advocate staff.
Okay.
So it'd be like myself or any of our advocates would go out to the scene.
Okay.
And then start shifts. Like he said, some would need to stay backed because judges, court still rolling.
Right.
And then the rest of us would respond to the scene. And at the Family Assistance Center, we could have a whole kind of scope of jobs where we're getting people on intake, we're trying to locate family members, we may be hooking them up with other resources that are there at the Family
mm-hmm.
Assistance
mm-hmm.
Center, and kind of really possibly just navigating them through what's going on and trying to get some of those services started, even though a lot of them are going to be in shock. So we're kind of working through that process as well.
Go ahead. Is there a training that they're going to be going through for this?
There is the initial training for this. Obviously, they're all subject matter experts in being victim advocates already. But there is it's a different environment when they go to a scene
Absolutely.
Like this. And I think, there's a specific training, crisis response training. It's a 3-day course that the advocates would go through. Beth and I mm-hmm. went through it not that long ago. It's a great course, very valuable information presented. and good insight from other victim witness units and district attorney offices who have handled such events. The folks from Ventura County were at our training and were very open about the lessons they learned and reinforced the need for having a plan and being prepared. Mm-hmm. So there is that specific training. There's some other training that involves, you know, dealing with death notifications, mm-hmm. trauma-informed care, things like that, FEMA courses on right. dealing with big events and the language spoken in those events in the incident command system. So there are some other trainings, and that's part of the plan as well, is getting the advocates who want to be part of this team through those trainings so that they're fully equipped to do the best they can.
Mm-hmm. We provided, Chris, we actually provided assistance to victims of the Vegas shooting. There were people from San Luis Obispo County that had either been at the concert or had family there at the concert.
I heard that, yeah.
So we kind of started doing that already through existing authority under state law. The fact that this grant became available was fabulous because it allowed us to dedicate a resource to really build the expertise around that and develop the networks and the relationships with our other partner agencies and other counties in our region so that we can provide the very best, very quick, agile response to victims whenever it happens. And our hope is that it doesn't happen. As Tim right. said, we'd, in fact, being a prosecutor, I'd love to be put out of business and see that crime goes down to nothing. But it's probably not if, but when. And so we're committed to making sure that we provide every possible resource to victims of crime wherever it happens, whether it be a mass victimization or a domestic violence or a theft, you know, something that's even seemingly more small. We want to provide the very best assistance to victims of crime here in San Luis Obispo County.
Dan, what, you know, as district attorney, what's one of the, I'm sure there are many, but what's something that really kind of, if you wake up at night, pops into your head about what you do or your job or something you're concerned about in your work and what we have here?
Well, over the last couple of years, one of the biggest kind of passions I have is to try to raise awareness around human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And because it's going on in our community and it's underneath the radar, people don't see it, don't believe it, and just don't understand it. And yeah. so we started our anti-human trafficking task force, which Beth is a big part of, mm-hmm. a few years back. And we've seen a remarkable success in terms of local understanding and acknowledging that it's happening. We still have a long way to go. And one of the reasons why it's so important to me is the fact that particularly these juvenile victims, there's nobody there that's even looking for them oftentimes. Right. Oftentimes they come from a very difficult background already. It might be thought that they're just a runaway, and so there's right. very little attention
and
being paid.
And they're not reported as missing.
That's right. right. Oftentimes they aren't. And so I want to make sure that our community, our law enforcement community, is doing everything we can mm-hmm. to gather any of the tips that might be out there where people think it might be happening and then acting on it. And so just this month, through myself and Ian, Sheriff Ian Parkinson, I've assigned one of our DA investigators to work on human trafficking full-time under the auspices of the Sheriff's Special Problems Unit. Basically, they have their gang task force, their narcotics task force, and that's kind of under this larger umbrella of Special Problems Unit. And so one of my investigators who has been with us on our anti-human trafficking task force is now dedicated to bringing our law enforcement partners together to do regular kind of proactive actions, law enforcement actions in our community to identify, seek it out, find it, and hopefully make some arrests, free victims, get them into the services, and then prosecute those that are committing those acts in our community, including the people that are quote-unquote purchasers. Mm-hmm. My view is if we can reduce the demand, and it's not just people that live in our community, but there's a large significant number of people in our community that create the demand. If we can go after that, the victims won't be brought in to meet that demand, quote unquote, that's there. And so when we do prosecute solicitation of prostitution and that sorts of thing, we are letting the community know who those defendants are. And we're putting that information out in the community because we want them to know that that demand is causing young people under the age of 18 to be oftentimes actually kidnapped and forced into this life that they really don't want to be involved in. And so to me, that's one of the things that nags at me at night Another thing recently is we've had an uptick in murders in our county.
I noticed.
We've had, you know, six murders essentially in the last 12 or 13 months. And a couple of them are still unsolved, and I want to see those cases get solved. I'm so thankful of the solving of the missing Nancy Woodrum case that she was missing for months and months before that case came to resolution. But it concerns me that that is a higher percentage of, you know, we haven't had that many murders in a year in a long time. I can't attribute that to anything other than it's probably just at a particular point in a cycle. But we are committed to working closely with all of our law enforcement partners to make sure those cases are fully investigated and prosecuted, and that we do what we can to hold offenders accountable and protect the rights of our crime victims.
You're listening to KCBX, and this is Central Coast Voices. If you just joined us and you are interested in hearing all of this show, you can do that on our archived website. You can go to kcbx.org, and you can go to Listen Now or go to the Voices, Central Coast Voices, and you can then listen to any of our past shows, including today's show, or you can go to iTunes and listen to our shows that way. My guests today are Dan Dow, County of San Luis Obispo, District Attorney, Beth Robb, Assistant Director of the Christopher G. Money Victim Witness Assistance Center, and Tim Murphy, Mass Victimization Advocate. You can call us. We probably have time for just one more call at 805-781-3875. 805-781-3875. I'm going to, as we're kind of wrapping up, I want to go back to you, Tim, and see, are there important things in your role with your program that's coming online that you really think are important for thing for people to be aware of?
Sure. Not so, thank you. Not so much in terms of the plan I'm building, because that's obviously still in development, but more so just steps they can take to best prepare themselves. The ready.gov website is a great resource for folks to take advantage of in terms of preparation for a variety of emergencies and disasters, earthquakes, tsunamis, fires, active shooters. So I would refer people to that website. It's a great source of information because the enhanced threat posed by people who are intent on committing an act of mass violence and how fast those unfold really does dictate that law enforcement, but also every one of us, just be as prepared as possible. Be alert. The mantra of see something, say something, it really is important for folks to understand that, and also understand that they're not a bother when they call 911 or call the police department to report something suspicious. I can say that from experience. We'd rather have someone call and report something suspicious, then find out after the fact and have that person say, oh, gee, I thought about calling, but I didn't think it was a big enough deal. Let the law enforcement folks get out there and put their eyes on it and listen to what the person's reporting as suspicious and figure it out from there. So being prepared, if you see something, say something, have a plan. Folks with children, you know, obviously deliver a message that we need them to deliver the message that's age appropriate for their kids. But a lot of folks, you know, it's okay to, or we all plan for, oh, God forbid an earthquake happens, what are we going to do? Or a fire in our house. It's okay to put things in those terms for a small child to get acclimated to the environment of, hey, know an alternate way out of your house or whatever location you're in. Events like these across our country have happened in everywhere from single family homes to government buildings, churches, schools, public music festivals. So really it is important for people to be prepared all the time. And you don't have to be, I'll just end with, you don't have to be scared or live in fear or be apprehensive. It's set your mind at ease by being prepared so that you don't have to be afraid.
Be awake. And Dan, for you too, in terms of the trafficking thing, are there things that people should look for and be aware of if they see certain things? That's kind of off.
Actually, one of our local law enforcement officers recently just doing a traffic stop saw some things that to him didn't seem to add up in terms of the age of the young person that was with the driver of the vehicle, the time of night that they were together, some of the other circumstances, and said, I'm going to look at this case a little differently than I would. I'm not just going to give him a ticket and let him go. I'm going to do a few other things. It's an example of what even a citizen could do. You know, if you happen to be out late at night and you see something like that, where there's a young person that doesn't appear to necessarily be the family of with that other person, and there's a significant age difference, it may not mean that there's a crime at all happening, but it may be worth, like Tim just said, see something, report it, calling law enforcement and say, there's something strange afoot. I'm not sure if it's appropriate, because in that particular case, the police officer did identify an actual human trafficking case going on in San Luis Obispo. And so there are other things. It's a little difficult, though, I will tell you, because it's done where the marketing is online. There are apps, yes. There are websites, yeah. There are peer-to-peer, you know, you get on a little app on your phone and you can, quote, order up, you know, some person to come to your home even. And oftentimes they're not billed as juvenile victims. They're adults supposedly looking for another adult service, and yet right. That service is being provided by a person under 18, yeah. A minor who's being marketed by oftentimes a gang member. So it's a little hard to tell. Some of the things that we talk about, maybe Beth can go into a few of the things that we tell the community to be looking for. Okay.
So, Beth, I'm going to go to you. Yeah. We've got a couple of minutes.
Oh, sure. For human trafficking, there's a lot of things to look for. Sometimes it's forced begging. And human trafficking can definitely be children. That's one of the things we focus on, but also adults. And so it could be forced begging. It could be sex trafficking. It could be labor trafficking. We had the case in Paso with the Moraleses that was labor trafficking. So things to look for is if people don't have access to their own IDs, if they...
When you're talking about forced begging, you're talking about children being asked to get money.
Or adults. One of the cases, I used to work at the Women's Shelter Program before it was Stand Strong, and one of the cases we had was a woman saw another woman begging at Food for Less, and in the car, she kept looking back behind her shoulder, and a man was sitting in the car watching her. Mm-hmm. And so she could tell she was being forced to stand out there and beg for money. Mm-hmm. Probably trafficking. She didn't know what to do. She came to me. By the time we reported it, they were gone.
Okay.
So it can be things like that. But for education, we do presentations around red flags and all the for human trafficking as well. And we do presentations to hotels because they need education. Obviously, because hotels are utilized.
Yeah.
And that's a new law where we're giving presentations and education to hotel workers to identify red flags for human trafficking. So if they do want a presentation or to hear more, I know we're running out of time, they can certainly call Victim Witness at 805-781-5821 and just ask for Beth. I do
great.
The outreach. So
I'm glad you gave the – and your website?
Yes, the website is slocounty.ca.gov/DA.
Okay. I want to thank my guest today, Dan Dow, County of San Luis Obispo Attorney, Beth Robb, Assistant Director, Christopher G. Money, Victim Witness Assistant Center, and Tim Murphy, Mass Victimization Advocate. Next week, join Fred Monroe and Central Coast Voices, sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation, and made possible by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Thank you for joining us.